I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, famous quotes, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous hosts, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Raven Puff Common Room.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And you've tuned in to the premiere episode of The Rambling Raven Puffs, the hottest new Harry Potter podcast to hit the air in 2021. So, who the hell are we? My name is Amy Sophia Mayer, and I'm a university administrator by day, but an indie writer, podcaster, and booktuber by night. I've got books and other podcasts galore. You can check them out at www.paganpoetess.com.
And my name is Jess. I am an artist, a avid reader, and a desk jockey by day. I am part of one of Amy's other podcasts, the Sublimely Gothic podcast, and not too active on social media, but just happy to be here.
So Jess and I met while I was advertising for a co-host for the Sublimely Gothic podcast. She's been part of that project since May of last year. So if you guys have any inclination for Gothic literature, go check that out too. We even have a whole episode devoted to the Gothic elements within Harry Potter.
But coming back to this podcast, what's with the name? We decided to call this podcast Rambling Raven Puffs because in our first few discussions of Harry Potter, we realized that we are both stark Hufflepuffs with strong Ravenclaw leanings.
Like, my sun sign is undoubtedly Hufflepuff, but my moon sign is definitely Ravenclaw. I'm not just making that up either. If you've seen any of those hybrid Hogwarts House personality quizzes online, I've always ranked highest in Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw. And also, it's nice because those are the two houses that get the least attention slash representation within the books because everyone's so focused on the Gryffindor-Slytherin dichotomy.
So how's this going to work? This is a reread podcast. We will cover two chapters per week, the majority of the episodes consisting of a free-flowing discussion about the plot, characters, and themes of the designated chapters. After our general discussion, we'll also do some little activities, such as
Gothic Geek Out, where Jess and I talk about any elements of the chapters that remind us of Gothic tropes, because that's what first brought us together.
Perfect. Famous quotes, where we each pick a quote from the chapter and pick apart the deeper meaning and implications.
And then finally, with fan fiction what ifs, where each of us will speculate if something happened differently. Each will pose that speculation to the other and have her predict how that would impact the rest of the book and or series.
There will also be wrap-up episodes at the end of each book and possible bonus episodes focusing on specific topics within the books and or fandom.
We're starting this podcast many, many months since J.K. Rowling's transphobic debacle on Twitter. Standing in solidarity with the trans community, I wish to engage with the Harry Potter books with the least amount of attention given to J.K. Rowling as humanly possible. To achieve this, I'm going back to my original theory from childhood that Harry Potter is real and that Harry wrote these books himself as an adult, using J.K. Rowling merely as a decoy slash pen name. So when I refer to the author, I shall be referring to adult Harry, who wrote these books as memoirs. Everyone got that? Good.
I love that. That's. And just a warning, this podcast will contain spoilers. While the focus of each episode will be the assigned chapters, we may or may not make allusions to future plot points. Listener discretion is advised.
And with that, let us revisit number 4, Privet Drive. As you mentioned, it's been a good decade since you've had a glance at Sorcerer's Stone, right?
Well, I just want to make this clear to everybody listening to this. If I sound naive or I don't know what a slanderous term, I'm going to assume it would be a muggle. When we're discussing these books, I am a bit older than Amy and I have read these books. It's been a while, so I'm not. So my reread felt like a genuine, almost new reread. Though some things came back to me when I was reading the book. I was like, oh, I remember that, and thought it was cool, mainly in chapter 2. But yeah. Yeah.
Long story short, I am the fanatical Potterhead, and Jess is the noob that will bring a new, fresh take on things.
Especially when it comes to the last few books, because I have not read them. Don't judge me. I feel like I know all the major spoilers, so it's okay. I will be all right.
Okay. Alrighty then. So, but let us start with chapter one, The Boy Who Lived. So what did you think about this? I remember you saying, like, you completely forgot that the book started with this sort of perspective from Uncle Vernon.
Well, exactly. In my mind, when I started reading this, the second chapter, The Vanishing Glass, was the beginning. But then the kind of background that you get in chapter one, I was like, well, obviously you couldn't have had chapter two without chapter one. So I really appreciated the first chapter. A lot of characters are introduced in this chapter. So I was surprised about that, to see so many characters that are iconic now revealed so early, and with so many other little nuances. And then it also made me think about the Harry Potter fanatics and just how detailed a lot of people are and the references that are made so early on. But so as the Harry Potter fanatic, rereading this first chapter, was it pure nostalgia, or was it just a good time? I don't know. What were your feelings?
My feelings? Again, it was a good sense of nostalgia. I actually listened to the audiobook because I was able to get it for free on Hoopla.
Nice.
So, you know, it's narrated by Jim Dale, who he does the American version. I have yet to listen to the Stephen Fry UK version because I couldn't find it accessible. But yeah, it was pure nostalgia, but also, again, totally rereading this from the premise that Harry wrote these himself. So that just put a whole new spin on the first chapter, because it opens with a perspective that is not Harry's.
Right. Yeah.
So the idea is, if we accept the premise that Harry is the narrator, so the whole sort of monologue and that Vernon has with himself, like, either that was purely creative license embellished, or Harry actually spoke to his uncle about this years later.
Interesting. Yeah. And I, now that we're calling that, you are taking that approach to it, that definitely does make that first chapter, the perspective a lot different, and it could be approached a lot of different ways. I appreciated the mundane in, Mr. Dursley's life. I highlighted the Mr. Dursley, however, had a perfectly normal, owl-free morning. He yelled at five different people. He made several important telephone calls and shouted a bit more. Being the office worker that I am, I was like, yeah, that is some people's like definition of a good day. So kind of the mundane that is definitely approached here with the Dursleys is, I don't know, you're definitely going to, you know, the contrast is coming. With Hogwarts and everything. But just seeing that at the beginning was kind of interesting and something I kind of forgot about.
And it's interesting to go back and see Uncle Vernon and by extension Aunt Petunia's worship of them, as you call it, the mundane, and just the idea of, because the way they describe, although everyone probably even knew even before it was published that it was about wizards and stuff, the way Uncle Vernon describes the Potters, like, you know, we don't want to mess with a crowd like that. Like, it's very much in the language of just, oh, like, you know, that is that one riffraff relative that you don't want to interact with in any way, shape, or form. So it's done in a very interesting way of showing, you know, we enshrine and we worship this notion of suburbia normal, and we will, like, do anything to preserve that bubble.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's so true. And I feel like I know people like that, but I'm not people like that. You know, none of my people have been people that like that. They're the people walking around in robes. I mean, sometimes literally. I don't know if I ever picked up on, when I started reading this, that the robes with the people walking around were representative of the houses this early on. And I thought that was kind of a cool thing.
I don't know if they necessarily are. Like, they are described in similar colors, but yeah, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. Maybe, like, someone has their old university sweater. Maybe they have their Hogwarts robe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know if it's like, you know, when we get to the Quidditch part, it's kind of like a college colors. I don't know. Some people like have an allegiance to a certain color, especially in the part of the country I am. Mm-hmm. Very much people will create their wardrobe around a certain color. So I didn't know if that was a Hogwarts alum thing too, but.
One thing I know is, again, just this worship of what is normal, and basically normal in the Vernon contrast is this sort of like British English suburbia. Like, honestly, like reading that, like how much they try, like, oh, these young people, look at the crazy robes that they're wearing. Like, honestly, it reminded me about, you know, my husband was being asked by a variety of news agencies to give like political analysis on the election. And so in preparation for that, he was listening to some of the Trump rallies. And one of the things that Trump like would constantly say is that like suburban moms love me because I'm here to preserve the safety and the normal of that area. I'm not going to allow like low income housing into your neighborhood, which again just makes me cringe because it's, again, you can try and say, oh, it's about keeping crime out, but it's also about, again, trying to bar people's social mobility and just hearing, you know, the way of life for Uncle Vernon and Petunia. It just reminded me of that.
Yeah, I thought so too. Like kind of holding the suburban ideology very precious and any deviation from that being very annoying, you know, just something just even a little different, and almost to a point with Mr. Dursley, Mrs. Dursley, they, you know, he's coming to bed, or, you know, she's about to go to bed. I don't remember. And he's like, I'm not going to mention anything about all this weirdness because I know I will get Petunia upset like immediately. And that's exactly what happens, because it's a reminder of this deviation of the normal and all of those things that you mentioned, which this book was written not in our current time. So I also thought about some of the, you know, just however many years later, changes in our society that aren't there in this book. Like it wasn't like, you know, Dudley, that's his name, right? Dudley.
Dudley.
The newest iPhone, you know, it wasn't stuff like that. It was, he wants a computer and things like that. That's more in the second chapter, but I thought about.
But yeah, no, it was interesting to read, to just approach this again, that, you know, it's in essence 25 years.
Wow, 25 years. Okay. I didn't.
96. And yeah, it's 2021.
Wow.
Like, I'm literally getting to a point, like, when I'm reading, because I do like historical fiction, I'm getting to a point where I view things set in the 90s as historical fiction.
I think it is. I mean, it really is. It's a weird thing to think
and
about.
People might think that's weird, but I don't think that's really out of place, especially because I feel like technology isn't growing at a linear pace, at it's going exponentially.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. I agree with all of that. And the 90s, I mean, there are already like documentaries about different things on the 90s. I just watched over the holiday a documentary on Heaven's Gate. And it's just weird because I remember Heaven's Gate. So I feel like I'm to that point in my life where it's like, oh, that's history that I just lived. So that's fun. But I've never been to the UK. I have watched a lot of British television. So kind of the life that they're presenting here, I don't know. I could only compare it with, you know, my kind of suburban upbringing. But beyond that, I guess it's probably not too much of a deviation from an American suburban upbringing.
Yeah, no. And then the Dursleys had everything they wanted, but they also had a secret. And their greatest fear was that somebody would discover it. And this just made me think, like, the way Mr. Dursley is approaching, he pretends that, you know, basically magic doesn't exist and everything, but he knows enough to put two and two together about the owls that are flying around and the shooting stars. He knows enough about that world that he is asking Petunias, like, have you heard from your sister recently? And that just made me curious. Like, so clearly he knows, like, what the real deal is, as much as he doesn't like it and tries to suppress it. But I'm just thinking, what is the cutoff of telling a muggle that magic exists?
Yeah, I don't know. And so, but they know. And here's a little bit of a gap in my knowledge. I think I know what the relationship is and how it got there. But as far as Lily and James, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to work something out in my mind as far as like the relationship and his level of knowledge about things versus what's just kind of out there publicly.
Yeah. And it just made me think of not so much what Petunia like would have told him just like within the confines of their relationship. I'm just wondering from a legal standpoint with the Ministry of Magic, what is the limit that a that someone like Petunia, who is a muggle relative of a witch, how much is she permitted to disclose? Is there a certain clause that, okay, you know, naturally he's your spouse, so you are allowed to tell him things because you're legally married? Like, how does that work?
Well, because you think there would be like a breakdown in this. I was just, that's what I was trying to work out a little bit. So if Petunia tells her husband, and that, you know, because of her sister, right, it's her sister, like, wouldn't everybody know about it? But I guess not.
I think we're supposed to take away, it's the general like consensus, unspoken sort of headcanon that the proportion of wizards compared to muggles is so, so low that it's okay for even random people like Uncle Vernon to know a little bit, because even that is like less than probably 10 or 5% of the population.
Gotcha. Okay. So it's not like everybody's like brothers, sisters, whatever. Has familiarity with witchcraft.
It's described as being a very, very selective minority that possesses magic, and so that's why they can get away with it, I think.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So again, yeah, like I love again what you said about Mr. Dursley yelled at five people, made important phone calls, and yelled some more. And again, in that notion of suburbia, just, you know, taking pleasure in these petty power trips. I don't know, for whatever reason, my YouTube has been recommending to me all these like news pieces about like HOA disputes and just these people, these like crazy suburbia tyrants trying to like, you know, exert their power or whatever.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, in the work environment, the thing that I've seen it see is just the different politics play out and how that does make people feel powerful, which is much more interesting knowing. And maybe that's part of his, like, if I'm going to psychoanalyze him, his disdain for Lily and James at the time is they truly do have power that they could, you know, use that's beyond.
To squish him like a bug.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beyond something as silly as just, you know, getting all worked up and being a Karen to somebody.
Yeah. So what is the male version of a Karen? Is it Darren?
I think I've heard it's a Chad, but I don't
know. A Chad? Okay. But basically, Petunia is most definitely a Karen before the label existed, and Uncle Vernon is a Chad. Well, the British forms.
Yes, yes. I'm not even going to guess what that would be, but 100%. And even down to how they treat their son. Oh my God.
Yeah. Indeed. And when Mr. Dursley goes to work, he spots a special tabby cat.
I loved that.
Did you remember who the tabby cat was?
I knew it was somebody, but I didn't remember who it was. And then when it was revealed, I was like, oh, yes. So, yeah.
When I was reading this, you know, as you know, I got an adorable new 7-month-old kitten. And his official name is Sir Francis Bacon, but we call him Mr. Bacon. And he, in essence, is a dark tabby with, like, those stripes. And he has, like, a bit of a white underbelly and white socks. But if he were not white at all, just that dark tabby color, that is exactly how I imagine Professor McGonagall to be in her cat form.
Yes, totally. That's exactly what I would envision as well. So that's... Oh, that's pretty cool.
They play it up that Mr. Dursley is kind of perturbed by this cat who is being like kind of sassy with him, or at least stern or whatever. And I'm like, you idiot, this is normal cat behavior. Have you never had a cat before?
My thoughts exactly. I was like, that's just kind of what cats do. He was probably reading into it or sensitive to something because he, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because the way, like, you know, they're, or maybe he's just extra paranoid because, again, of the owls and the shooting stars. But yeah, the what it shows that McGonagall, exactly the behavior she does in her cat form, is not out of the ordinary. And even when he comes back from work and she just gives him this cold look, and I'm like, yeah, cats do that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We have cats. We know how they are.
Mm-hmm. So when they're talking about the people in cloaks, Mr. Dursley couldn't bear people who dressed in funny clothes. Like, that made me think of, again, there was another, you know, news piece about Karens and Chads, you know, specifically trying to police people's clothing and appearances.
Mm. Oh.
And one specifically was, there was a, you know, young woman who had a pretty revealing bikini. And this older woman, like, came up to her and is like, you know, cover yourself. My teenage boys are staring at you, and basically holding her responsible for her son's behavior, even though they're at a beach.
Oh, my. That's a wonderful. I went to Catholic school, so I had a lot of policing of what I wore. And I could not.
Yeah, and I was going to ask that. The way Mr. Dursley is, you know, dissing on other people's clothing, Not directly to them, but just to himself. Like,
right.
Is there any particular experience you had of people trying to police your clothing?
Well, yes. Yes. I went to Catholic elementary school and high school. So that is kind of what they're all about. And I don't know. At the time, it was very annoying and, you know, felt limiting on self-expression and things like that, which I still think so. Then, you know, I kind of, as an adult, sometimes I'm like, I kind of wish somebody would just tell me what to wear so I wouldn't have to think about it. Now, in the situation I am in now, I don't really have to think about it too much. But did you have that experience or
the only thing that really comes to mind is it wasn't even like my regular academic advisor. So it's my undergrad in college at Syracuse University in upstate New York. And it was like for autumn. And so I was wearing basically a sweater dress with colored like tights underneath.
Okay.
So like my whole body was covered. It was just very form-fitting.
Yeah.
And I had to go to a certain office. I had to get something signed by whoever for, like, I don't know if it was course transfer. I don't know even what the paperwork was about. But one of the people or secretaries that was like in the area while I was like waiting to get this, you know, errand taken care of, had the audacity to say that, like, I would never let my daughter or daughter-in-law, like, go out looking like that.
Oh, my God. That's...
And again, this is college.
Right.
Yeah, this is college. She doesn't know me from Adam. And, yeah.
It just... Now, it would be interesting to ask somebody, like, Morgan, or, you know, he's had that experience, because I'm guessing probably not, definitely not to that level.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the instances that really showed me like the big cultural divide, because I grew up on the West Coast, like in Oregon, and, you know, been to California a lot, where much more fashionable or fashion forward, whatever we want to call it. And then going to like upstate East Coast culture and just the huge discrepancy. And it's like no one would bat an eyelash if I were in like San Francisco.
Yeah, it is interesting how regionally that differs so much. Something that somebody wouldn't look twice at.
Yeah, but basically, yeah, Mr. Dursley is a Karen who hates people in cloaks because he has to have everything a certain way, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a fun person to have a conversation with, so.
Mm-hmm. And so again, but he gets this, you know, unsettling feeling because he realizes not only are there weird things happening, but they also hear the Potters mentioned. The Potters? That's right. That's what I heard. Yes, their son, Harry. And so now he's just like, and then he asks his wife, you know, who, like, what is his, what is my nephew's name again? Harold. And Petunia's like, Harry, nasty common name. And he's like, oh, crap.
That kind of... Well, first of all, it reminded me of a couple of things. Like, if you're thinking, if you're waiting for a sign from the universe, you kind of sometimes, and it's not really the one that you want, it's kind of like, no, maybe that's not what they meant. So I was thinking about him walking around hearing Potters and Harry, and he's like, no, probably a lot of people name that. It's like, come on, guy. And the common name thing kind of made me laugh because I felt like that was a very British thing to say. I'm having no like context for that. It just felt like very, well, his name is what his name, I forgot what his name is. Vernon, mm-hmm. Petunia and Dudley.
Yeah.
I guess those names don't sound like royalty. I don't know.
It's just kind of interesting that he has this response that Potter is such a common name, because if we want to get into deep Harry Potter trivia, you know, the Potters were a pureblood wizarding family, but they actually were left off this certain list of pureblood families because they felt the Potters was too common of a name that was shared with Muggles, so like they didn't put it on the like genealogy list.
Oh, okay.
So like even in the wizarding world, there was like, oh, Potter is such a common name. It's such a pity that there's this pureblood family who has that name.
Dang. That's kind of judgy, but that's all right. That's all right.
Yeah, well, these books talk about a lot of judgy things.
Yeah.
In terms of, again, Mr. Dursley, I tend to think that Harry maybe sort of embellish this, because I just don't think it's very likely that he actually talked to Uncle Vernon afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, there comes a point to the books, as far as I've read, where eventually they stop. They kind of had started at the Dursleys and then they kind of stop starting there. So I kind of wondered that too, given the horribly abusive treatment of Harry that's demonstrated in the next chapter. I was like, I'm wondering there's ever any communication with this guy again. So
yeah, from what has been said, Harry basically kind of reconciles and is on speaking terms with Dudley once he's out of his parents' influence, but I don't think there ever was between Petunia, Vernon, and Harry.
I don't blame him in the slightest.
I don't either. So but anyway, we get to the point where Mr. and Mrs. Dursley go to bed and this really funky guy comes walking down the street.
Good old, that's Dumbledore, right? That's who it was.
Yes, Dumbledore. Yeah. And Dumbledore is either a Middle English or Old English word for bumblebee.
Really?
Yeah, Dumbledore, bumble.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
This is what you know when you're a linguistic nerd.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you know why the name, like that was the name that they...
I have no idea why, but...
It's a cool fact. I like it very much.
Yeah. So, and it's basically, you know, he is the quintessential sort of Merlin-looking wizard. He has a huge, long, silver beard. He's in robes. He has these heeled boots with buckles on them, like from the 18th century that guys used to wear.
Yes. Little half moon glasses, loves a lemon drop. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I think, and again, going to this part of the story, it's definitely my theory is, you know, certainly the Uncle Vernon part was embellished or maybe created by Harry, but I think maybe he would have approached McGonagall like years later and maybe asked her like exactly how this happened.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense to
So I like to think that Harry and McGonagall talked about this as he was writing his book.
I think that's a cool way to kind of get that perception there.
Mhm. So yeah, I don't think this is my first observation of this, but basically what adult Harry is trying to portray to the readers is that Albus Dumbledore is this very powerful wizard and people respect him, but he's also kooky and insane.
Yeah, and I thought kind of surprisingly even keeled from what I remember. Like somebody who, I guess I didn't really like think of him as kind of erratic by any means, but definitely very, very level, which I appreciated that. He wasn't a volatile person. He was just kind of like, all right, stuff's going to work out the way it needs to and it's all good. And I was like, I like that attitude. That's a good attitude to have.
Yeah, it's like, fancy seeing you here, Professor McGonagall. He turned to smile at the tabby, but it had gone. Instead, it was smiling at a rather severe-looking woman. How'd you know it was me? My dear professor, I've never seen a cat so stiffly. Which makes me think, like, you know, they work together at the school. Right. He knows she can transform into a cat, which I think goes to show just how valuable, like, people want to say, oh, if I could turn into a animal, I'd want to be a wolf, or, like, all these crazy, you know, majestic things. But the most simplest things are the most stealthy, so that even someone who works with you for a really long time can't immediately recognize, oh, that's Professor McGonagall.
Yeah, that's a good deception and way to kind of infiltrate the normal world in a facade such as that.
Yeah, and then of course here we get the sort of introduction of Dumbledore is wise but kooky, and then Professor McGonagall as very stern and basically rule abiding.
Which, God love her for that, I guess. That character stuck in my mind. I forget the actress who plays her.
Oh, Dame Maggie Smith.
Yes, Maggie. Oh gosh. For some reason I thought Angela Lansbury. That was wrong. Yeah, I got a very vivid image of her in my mind. But so they kind of like level each other out a little bit. We have kind of like rule abiding and then a little bit more laid back and in my mind of the two. And then they're fussed. She was upset because Hagrid was delayed. Is that right?
Yes. Well, she's just generally irritated about everyone being so careless with their owls and their shooting stars. And she's like, the Muggles aren't stupid.
Well, that is a sentiment that I feel like later on in the books that is a lot of people think Muggles are just a bunch of idiots. So she's throwing some credit that way.
Yeah. And it's just kind of, you know, thinking about the overarching prejudice of this series, even for maybe witches and wizards like McGonagall, who don't look down on Muggles. In fact, Harry Potter trivia, McGonagall's father is a Muggle. She's half blood.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So even if you don't think, oh, that, you know, we should be above them, there still is this tendency. And I think it's natural that by having power and they don't, you see them as childish.
That would make sense because they don't have a thing. I guess without trying to explain it, it makes sense that that's the way they would think.
Yeah. So McGonagall is all, you know, criticizing everyone's recklessness and carelessness. And Dumbledore's like, you can't blame them. We've had precious little to celebrate for 11 years. And that just I think it really hit home for me that they've been dealing with this maniac that is this antagonist of Voldemort for over a decade.
Wow. I mean, we don't. I'm sorry. I'm trying to. I mean, you know, we don't have to have that long of a time to deal with maybe something similar. I don't know, but it's a long time to deal with something.
Not have that person be any sort of political power to just, you know, basically in 1970 Voldemort was like, yep, I'm here, deal with it, bitches, and wreaked havoc, you know, for 11 years. Now it's 1981.
Yeah, that's a lot to deal with for that long. Even though he's not a political influence, he definitely was an influence, a terrifying influence, to the point that some people don't even say his name.
And she and Dumbledore get into that. Dumbledore's like, why won't you use his name? You're a sensible person. And she's like, I know, but you're different. Everyone knows you're the only one, you know who, or oh, all right, Voldemort was frightened of. You flatter me, said Dumbledore calmly. Voldemort has powers I will never have, only because you're too, well, noble to use them.
I liked that little exchange there, and I think it was interesting to have her character not, you know, say the name after being convinced that it was okay, and it just made me think about different beliefs people have that they hold on to, even though when, you know, you might meet a person that is very smart, and then they kind of cling on to this one really quirky, nonsensical belief. I liked that little character trait there. I thought that was interesting.
Yep. And again, it's lucky it's dark. I haven't blushed so much since Madame Pomfrey told me she liked my new earmuffs. Again, trying to emphasize that Dumbledore is powerful, Dumbledore is wise, but also Dumbledore is a little kooky, shall we say.
I like him for that. I was like, I didn't remember that I liked him as much as I like him just based on this first chapter. So,
and then we get to a really sad, somber part where Dumbledore confirms that Lily and James Potter are dead.
Yes. And that is, I know eventually throughout the books that becomes more of a deal. I mean, of course, thus making Harry an orphan, that's always a big deal to him. But as far as their history, I think it comes out later on to explain the depth there.
And McGonagall is really, really distraught by this because you got to think, you know, both Lily and James were students of hers in her house in Gryffindor. So she knew them at least a little bit.
And they were, I mean, from my assessment thus far, they were pretty well liked. I mean, it wasn't like some Dursley, you know, they were like, all right, good riddance. But this one was very impactful. But kind of it was interesting to have the sadness of losing those two with the defeat of the supposed defeat of Voldemort kind of on the same day. That kind of, or he disappeared, right? That's why everybody was celebrating. He wasn't defeated so much as he just wasn't there. Maybe I didn't get that.
Yeah, basically McGonagall says no one knows why or how, but they're saying that when he couldn't kill Harry Potter, Voldemort's power somehow broke, and that's why he's gone. And so basically we're to infer, again, there is no body, so Voldemort is not, you know, I don't consider anything in mystery novels, no one's ever dead until there's a body.
So true. So true.
And also, yeah, it's just the sense that it's kind of implied that somehow his spell backfired, like when he tried to curse Harry and it basically, you know, destroyed him.
Mm. Okay, and that's what we think right now.
Yeah, that's kind of the very general how it's sort of described, and then we get much more detail much later on.
Okay, okay.
So yeah, so now at this point, Lily and James Potter are dead, and so, but the boy survived. And so now Harry is going to go live with Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon. And I really like McGonagall's like original objection to this.
Yeah.
She's like, you can't mean the people who live here. Dumbledore, you can't. I've been watching them all day. You couldn't find two people who are less like us, and they've got this son. I saw him kicking his mother all the way up the street, screaming for sweets. Harry Potter, come and live here?
Okay, open to that page. Yeah, that was kind of, again, like, and then we get, I'm assuming, which is fairly famous, right? There will be books written about Harry. Every child in our world will know his name.
Yes.
So this, she's like, this is a very, very special person. And I'm seeing people being treated horribly, and we're going to leave this special, very special person with these people? Like, no. So, and then kind of Dumbledore kind of reassures her a little bit.
A little bit. I think one thing I noticed about McGonagall's character that I haven't really noticed in other rereadings before this is how maternal she is towards Harry in certain ways, because, you know, we get the sense of McGonagall again throughout the series that she, even though she's kind and good and stuff, but that again, she's very strict and she doesn't allow herself to play favorites like some of the other teachers at Hogwarts that we'll get to. But, you know, the idea that, and this is a theme that will come up a lot, is, you know, Dumbledore is purely at this level point just thinking, how do I physically keep Harry safe?
Right. Right.
Whereas McGonagall is more thinking of both that and also his mental well-being. And, you know, she's thinking about the implications of leaving this sort of child with these people who hate magic.
Do you think that there is any sort of, and maybe here's my guessing speculation part, is there any part of Dumbledore that knows kind of the truth about Voldemort, and therefore he's just trying to hide him out for a little while? Or is that not the case at all?
It's implied, even in the earlier books, I think, that Dumbledore knows that because there's not a body, that this is only temporary.
Okay.
And he doesn't want Harry to have this really high-profile life.
Gotcha.
Because of it.
Okay.
So he portrays it as, so again, he's got his reasons because he knows that the threat isn't completely over and it's much in Harry's physical best interest to, you know, live a quieter life in the muggle world until he finally enters the wizarding world at 11. But again, but this will happen several times in the books where McGonagall, while she always respects Dumbledore and will defer to his judgment, but you do see her push back sometimes about, like, what is best for Harry mentally.
Okay.
And I never really thought about that before in depth, but I admire her for that. And in fact, they even expand upon this sentiment in, like, one of the scenes in the fourth movie. Like, they have a scene between McGonagall, Dumbledore, and Snape, which, again, totally invented, wasn't in the books, or at least wasn't shown in the books, playing up this same thing of McGonagall's, like, thinking of what's best for Harry, like, psychologically, and Dumbledore thinking more about, you know, keeping Harry physically safe, but also using Harry in a way as a chess piece in this bigger game.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, I didn't really think that much about it, but, yeah, that came to mind. And then the same thing when Hagrid finally shows up and she sees the scar and she's like, can't you do anything for him, Dumbledore? Because, again, she's just thinking about, oh, this poor kid has to live with this scar.
Right. And I think I really liked what he said. Even if I could, I wouldn't. Scars can come in handy. I have one above my left knee that is a perfect map of the London Underground. I was like, that's a weird quirk that I don't know. And then I was wondering, has that ever been shown, like, in cinema? Is that level of detail something that, I mean, I know he's always, like, walking around in a robe or something in Fantastic Beasts. I don't know if he was, like, ever hanging around with shorts or anything. I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah, no, we've never physically seen that scar. No.
Okay. Okay.
And then Hagrid comes and brings little baby Harry.
Yes, and he makes quite the entrance.
What did you think of his entrance?
I thought it was pretty intense. Like, for, I don't fully understand the way everything works in the Muggle versus Hogwarts wizarding world. So he basically crashed a giant motorcycle into a tree, right? And I was kind of like, wow, I feel like that would wake up some neighbors, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think we're to imply that either Dumbledore and or McGonagall place some sort of silencing charms so that nothing is going to wake the Muggles.
That is a wise thing to do. So,
and it's interesting, you know, McGonagall's at first hesitant, like, Hagrid is bringing Harry. I would trust Hagrid with my life, said Dumbledore. I'm not saying his heart isn't in the right place, for Professor McGonagall said grudgingly, but you can't pretend he's not careless. He does tend to... And so she's admitting Hagrid's weaknesses, because these are weaknesses that we will see many times over in the future books.
Yes, and when I was reading that, I was like, I feel like I'm a bit of a Hagrid. I've done a character test before, and I actually like there's a personality test you can do that assesses, like, every character from TV, film, book, or some whatever. And I am a character in Harry Potter, but it is not Hagrid. Even though when I read this, I feel like I'm saying his heart isn't in the right place. So I'm like, that could be said for me sometimes. My heart's in the right place. And sometimes I'm just a little flaky. So I felt a little Hagrid-like. I don't drive. I would never get on a motorcycle. So let's just make that clear before we get too far. I'm too scared.
Yeah, would you get on a flying motorcycle?
Maybe.
Maybe. Would you prefer a broomstick or a flying motorcycle?
Ooh, that's a great question. I feel like you've thought about this one. I'm going to say motorcycle. Why not? What about you? Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't want either. I'd want a dragon.
Oh, well, there we go. I didn't know that was an option.
I'm curious how you thought of when you heard this, like, Hagrid, at last, and where did you get that motorcycle? Borrowed it, Professor Dumbledore, sir, said the giant, climbing carefully off the motorcycle as he spoke. Young Sirius Black lent it to me. I got him, sir. So you know the whole deal with Sirius Black. You've read up to that part, I know.
Yes, but I'm not clear-minded enough. As I've been reading this, things have been coming back to me. Werewolf, right? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
Somebody else. We'll revisit that later.
Okay. Okay. What I did, you know, something, I'm just going to make a comment. There are a lot of characters introduced in this one chapter. Like I was
indeed, and again, just like the little hints, like not just physically seeing Hagrid, McGonagall, Dumbledore, but even the hints of Sirius Black and just other little hints throughout. You can very much see that, especially with books 1, 2, and 3, they're very interwoven and very, very connected. And then book 4 starts to expand the world even more. But you can see that Harry writes it in a way that all of this is connected, you know, especially very tightly within the first 3 books.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I mean, that just, it surprised me because I'm like, okay, I know this character comes up later, this blah, blah. And it was just kind of a little overwhelming to me because, like, I think I've mentioned previous that so many iconic characters kind of at the very beginning of the book, it was a lot.
Yeah. And then, yeah, so we have little Harry, who is only like a year old. And bear in mind, all of this is November 1st, because Lily and James were attacked on Halloween night. So this is November 1st, 1981.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I'm curious about the timeline. Like, if McGonagall wasn't sent by Dumbledore to keep an eye on the Dursleys, then what inspired her to go to the Dursleys once she heard all these rumors about James and Lily? Did she think, okay, Lily and James got attacked? Super Harry Potter trivia. There's no other living Potters. So maybe she was just thinking, okay, Lily got attacked. I should keep an eye on maybe her sister or whatever. I don't know.
I don't know either. But I guess the only thing I could think about is if, you know, there's a horrible loss in a family, it's just like a next of kin situation. But I don't know.
Yeah. And speaking of next of kin, and okay, I'm curious, like, what legal power does Dumbledore have in giving Harry to the Dursleys? Because given the relationship between Petunia and Lily, I don't think Lily would have entrusted Harry to her sister, you know, in her wills, like, if something happens to me, he goes to my sister. I don't think that was written anywhere.
Yeah, probably not. But especially based on what we'll learn about in the next chapter.
Lily would not have done that to Harry, because Lily knows Petunia and dealt with her and everything. So this is Dumbledore purely making things up as he goes. And yeah. It says something about, like, you know, again, dealing with crazy wizard terrorist Voldemort for 11 years, that things have so crumbled to the point that Dumbledore, who has no technically legal power to do so, is making decisions for Harry Potter. And people are just letting him do it.
Yeah, everybody just, like, trusts him so much. They're like, we just know you have the, like, best interest. Is it somebody's best interest? I guess. I don't know. If some random, like, person came and got me, I guess, like you said, that this is kind of the only family that's there. So I don't know. Is he, like, the state or something coming in and taking control? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm, and again, I think it's heavily implied that, you know, the ministry is so overrun or, like, dealing with so much crap and just dealing with all this, again, stuff with Voldemort and trying to hide everything that the Muggles, that I think just everybody's worn down to the point that they're just like, yeah, we trust Dumbledore. He can do whatever he wants.
I could understand that. Like I said, I'm a fan, so.
So, alrighty. And then they put baby Harry on the doorstep and Hagrid is crying and it's so sad.
Yes, very sad. And then they put the little letter by him, and then Mrs. Dursley screams when she opens the door when she finds little Harry with his little letter.
Yep, and then the last few sentences, Harry couldn't have known at this very moment people meeting in secret all over the country were holding up their glasses and saying in hushed voices to Harry Potter, the boy who lived.
off to a interesting start there. Just again, that was so much packed into one chapter. Like, and I feel like that how every one of these chapters is when I've read these books. It's like, oh my gosh, it's a lot.
Okay. Chapter 2, The Vanishing Glass. So yeah, and again, it's just really nice that Harry, adult Harry, writer Harry, went out of his way to write this chapter right before he just went into his own life and his own memories, that just kind of, you know, showing, like, the foundation of everything that happened that night.
Yes, kind of. So this is 10 years after, and then he kind of gets into the treatment that he's dealing with up to leaving for Hogwarts. And just how I remember when I read this. So this is a bit of things that I remember. I read a book called A Boy Called It, or The Boy Called It. It was a popular book. Horrible child abuse with this kid and how he kind of like survived it. And I think I read that shortly, maybe around the time when I read this book, the first go. And I remember being so distressed by the treatment of Harry. And just, I have talked about my dislike of spiders. So this is probably what really did it for me. He found a pair, he was looking for some socks. He found a pair under his bed after pulling a spider off one of them, put them on. Harry was used to spiders because the cupboard under the stairs was full of them. And that's where he slept. I was like, oh my God, that is
trigger warning.
Yes, yes, for sure.
Yeah, it's, I'm just thinking, you know, they come from the same household. Like, so I'm just thinking, you know, social workers, teachers, how did no one piece together that these two boys live in the same house and they look completely different? Like in terms of like nourishment and, you know, maybe and neglect and all these things. Like, how did Vernon and Petunia get away with treating Harry this badly for so long?
That's a great point, because I was thinking about that as well. And I was like, he was in school, right? And then I'm, you know, kind of through my reading, like, oh yeah, he was. So what is going on? Because he gets made fun of for the way he looks, his crazy hair, his oversized clothes. And then you have the description of Dudley is pretty funny. I highlighted it. Lots of pictures of what looked like a large pink beach ball wearing different colored bonnets. But Dudley Dursley was no longer a baby. And now the photographs showed a large blonde boy riding his first bicycle. And then it kind of goes on.
And these books have been criticized a lot for the easy demonization of Dudley and by extension Uncle Vernon through fat phobia.
Yes, I noticed that a lot.
So that's something, you know, that is worthy of discussion. And then, but again, if we think the premise, not excusing it by any means, but when we think of Harry, like telling this story again from his memories, thinking about, you know, Harry maybe honing in on that element of Dudley and Uncle Vernon because he is so malnourished.
Yeah, if you can, if I think that's a good way to think about it, the contrasting, and hopefully that's the way I wanted to present it, was the contrast of somebody who has everything to the point where they're not hungry, where Harry's often sent to bed without food, and therefore, you know, his Dudley's clothes kind of swallow him. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I kind of wondered if that had been something that people just kind of accepted and were like, well, this, you know, whatever. I'm also a person that grew up when the kind of preferred aesthetic of women was like was heroin chic, like very, very, very thin women. And this was kind of at the end of that. You know, people didn't talk about fat phobia and things like they do in our modern time when these books came out. So
were not talking about this in the 90s. No,
they definitely were not. So Dudley obviously has a surplus of things to eat, things to play with, clothes to wear. He's fine. Where poor Harry's down there getting spiders crawling all over him.
Yeah, and I think it's something to be said of, like, in a way this is a children's book, so Harry's maybe just describing the like sort of Cinderella like effect of him basically, you know, having to cook and clean, and you know it, you know, the type of abuse he shows is very much neglectful, not so much like active like hitting him. Although we don't know if that didn't happen. I'm sure it did.
Yeah, it reminded me. I actually knew a person in high school that kind of had a similar treatment by her family. She was basically the Harry Potter of her family. Basically like a little servant. And
to me that doesn't mean that the abuse is any less like damaging, especially like seeing the contrast of, obviously they want to spoil their son, but how much is there actions towards Dudley dictated by, I want to give my son everything so that my nephew feels like crap. I'm sure that's pushing the behavior a little bit.
Right. It's kind of to further kind of distress Harry. It's almost feels like it's not, it's double-edged, you know, it's to benefit Dudley and then to kind of slight Harry.
Indeed. And so, yeah. And so Harry has to deal with the cooking the bacon, and she's like, and don't burn it. I want everything perfect. And I'm just thinking, I really like my bacon super crispy. What about you?
I'm a vegetarian, so
I forget.
Yeah, I was like, well, I don't know. I know, but my husband prefers it a little crispy. So
yeah, like just the fatty part when it's not cooked properly. Bleh.
Yeah, well. Yeah, I know how some people prefer it, and he like sneaks a little piece of it, right, or something.
Or he has a little bit. Oh, so with Harry, yeah, when he was dressed, he went down the hall into the kitchen. The table was almost hidden beneath all Dudley's birthday presents.
Oh yeah,
37 presents for an 11-year-old.
Maybe that's like something that the reality of. Kids I know these days, but I was kind of, I mean, that's extreme. The fact that actually was surprised that he remembered, like, he's like, cause he gets mad. He's like 37, like, what the hell? And, or 36, that's two less than last year. I'm like, dude, I don't remember what I bought at the store last week. Like, it's great that he remembers that, but I guess that's just a testament to how spoiled he is.
Yes, indeed. And even me over Christmas, I got a lot of books for Christmas this year, and it might have been up to 30, but I can only have it up to 30 because I bought those ebook collections that was like together, like 20 novels, but that was like together $5.
Yeah. Well,
like, I cannot fathom giving. And it also says something about Dudley, you know, the Dursley's socioeconomic status, like, it's kind of shown that generally they're like middle class. I guess maybe they're upper middle class, because I'm just thinking, like, how can they afford to like spoil Dudley this much?
Right. It's not like, and he gets like a bike, a computer. He gets all kinds of several video games. Like,
he got a VCR, and that made me feel old.
Me too. Well, I know, like, with video games, I guess, you know, if we put it in the context of now, video games are like $60 a game, I think. I don't know. I'm not.
But no, that's very true. They can be pricey. I only know this because I don't play video games that much, but my sister and brother-in-law do. Anytime there's a new Legend of Zelda, they go get it. Skyward Sword, Breath of the Wild, you name it.
I know a lot of people that are into games. I just know I used to work at a game store, and so I know they're pricey.
So, but they get a phone call, and basically they're so mean to Harry that every time it's Dudley's birthday, they never bring him with them on their little outing. They always keep him with the neighborhood cat lady, Mrs. Fig.
That's a bit much, because he would ruin Dudley's time, right?
Yeah, and I think it says a lot about, it's not purely just neglect. You know, there's a difference between, you know, the age-old saying, hate is not the opposite of love, it's indifference. And so they are not in any way showing an indifferent type of neglect towards Harry. They're showing a type of neglect that I want you to be miserable.
Right, yeah, it's very, very methodical.
Yes, methodical is exactly the word. And so Mrs. Fig, what, did she break her leg? Like, she can't take Harry. She cannot babysit him. And literally, they're thinking of all the people they could possibly pawn Harry off on. And Harry is just like, you know, I can stay at home. And Petunia's like, and leave the house in ruins. And he's like, I'm not going to blow anything up. But the reality is, they know he could blow something up.
That was a great way to kind of introduce that, because you're kind of like, why are these people being so horrible that they don't want him coming with them, but they also don't want him by himself? And then we get into all the reasons why they don't want him by himself, and the weird,
and then even just leaving him in the car. Vernon's like, that car's new, he's not sitting in it by himself.
Right,
And so finally, there's nothing else for it. They can't do anything. And it's just, it was so heartbreaking to me. I don't know if this had as much of an impact in previous readings, but the fact that despite these people hating him, like Harry knows they hate them, but still feeling such joy that through this circumstance and serendipity that he, despite these people really not being nice to him, that he gets to go to the zoo and he just focuses on that and is so happy about it.
It was like, I think adult me was a little more heartbroken because it's like, oh my gosh, it was because he describes it like as the best day for a while. What does he say? Harry had the best morning he had had in a long time. It's like, oh my God, it's so sad.
Yeah. And again, because he couldn't, you know, because he was forced to, you know, go with them in a way. And I remember just the little at the ice cream stand that they gave, that they had to buy Harry something because, you know, the ice cream lady was like, and what do you want, young man? Before they could say, no, he doesn't get anything.
Right, right. Yeah. That was, it was all very heartbreaking, but you kind of like, for me, I was like, well, at least he's got like something. He's got to go hang out with spiders later. But right now he's like at the zoo.
Well, and I think it's certainly probably a coping mechanism that, because there have been a lot of criticisms of the books that Harry is way too high functioning in his life and in his teenage years for all this crap he went through as a kid.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, but again, but we see here that the way he does it is he focuses on the one good thing.
Yeah, which, hey, that's and a very healthy coping mechanism.
Which it is healthy. It's just heartbreaking that that's the only thing he has to focus on. But in right. terms of maintaining one's sanity, that is the thing you should do.
Right, exactly. Yes.
And it's not just Harry and Dudley. Dudley's friend Piers also goes with them to the zoo.
Yeah, he becomes important kind of at the end of this, but he isn't there. I don't feel like he's very fleshed out. Like,
no, I'm not even sure. Yeah, why they specifically brought him in, but anyway. So, of course, the big scene is when they are in the reptile room.
And
I'm curious, you know, go through like your general reaction response to this as not after not reading it for a while.
This was the part that I was like, I remember that because I don't know why, but this whole scene, maybe as an animal lover, it was kind of like, that was cool to have that. And that's also kind of the first, like, him experiencing his own magic in the real world that we get to see. You know, we learn prior to this that there are instances of, like, his uncontrolled, you know, things that happen that he's just like, oh, I don't know what I did. And this, even at this, he doesn't know. He just knows he's having this conversation. And, it's called Parcel Tongue. Is that right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. A small victory for me today. But which I know there's kind of more complication with that later on. But I don't know. I really like that little scene in the vanishing glass. And that's the reason the title is called the title. What about you?
Well, I was thinking, you know, I didn't think about it too hard. Again, what I really like about doing this podcast and only reading like two chapters per week, because it really makes me sit and think about each specific chapter rather than whizzing through it like I usually would.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing I thought about that I didn't think about that deeply before was the fact that of all the possible sort of random pieces of magic that manifest themselves, Harry makes the glass in the boa constrictor's cage disappear. And I think that, at a subconscious level, is indicative of Harry's desire for freedom. He feels trapped by his life with the Dursleys, and so, in a subconscious way, he's giving freedom to another trapped being.
Right, yeah, very much so. That's a good connection.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, just, and I guess I didn't quite remember the snake being quite so sassy, but he is.
He is pretty sassy. I liked that whole conversation. It was nice to also, again, kind of with the happiness being sad, it was kind of sad because he kind of felt like he found a friend and it was this giant snake. I don't know. It was interesting.
One thing that caught my attention was, as far as Harry had seen, the snake hadn't done anything except snap playfully at Dudley's heels as it passed, but by the time they were all back in Uncle Vernon's car, Dudley was telling him how it had nearly bitten off his leg. And I'm just thinking, you know, because Harry is a parcel mouth and understands, you know, the snake in ways that other people can't, not even other wizards can't, I'm wondering how credible is Harry's interpretation that, you know, Harry knows that the snake was just being sassy as it left, but Dudley doesn't know that. The Petunia doesn't know that, or no one else knows that. So I feel like Harry's like, not that Dudley doesn't deserve a good scare for all the crap he's given Harry, but I don't think Harry's in a position to properly explain the behavior of the snake to other people.
Right. Yeah. He didn't. What was no big deal to him might be a little bit more of a big deal to somebody else. Like, that's a good observation as well. And I kind of took that as, you know, Dudley was just, I don't know. It's kind of like the story of like, I caught a fish that this was this big and then it keeps growing.
So, yeah. And what really makes me hate peers in this chapter is because Vernon and Petunia were not there specifically when the glass vanished. So they couldn't directly pin it on Harry. But then Piers opens his big mouth and says, Harry was talking to it, weren't you, Harry?
Yeah, he kind of came out of nowhere. I was like, first of all, totally forgot Piers was even there for a while. And then he comes out with this. And I was like, dude, just keep it to yourself for a second.
Yeah, and that is enough for Uncle Vernon to suspect that it was Harry who did it, and just basically locking him in the cupboard as punishment with no meals.
And full of spiders to hang out with. Sounds awful.
Yeah. And then one thing is that when he had been younger, Harry had dreamed and dreamed of some unknown relation coming to take him away, but it had never happened.
Sad. And he has the strange vision of, doesn't he say he's dreamt about the motorcycle?
And indeed.
Feels like it's real, but.
Yeah, and basically, yeah, that's how the chapter ends, with Harry in trouble in his cupboard, blamed for something that he didn't even know that he did.
Yeah. So that was a bummer, that part, that whole chapter. I mean, you got some good stuff with the snake, but the rest was kind of sad.
Yeah, it's. As a children's book, it doesn't go too much into like really hardcore like physical abuse or anything. But even just reading that, like that level of like emotional abuse and neglect, you know, it's very troubling to read sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely was for me. And I think that there's I have a feeling a lot of kids have felt kind of Harry Potter like, maybe not on that like extreme level, but just kind of, you know, not wanted. Or like a servant. Yeah,
the black sheep, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you like to move to the exercise of Gothic Geek Out?
Sure. I think I found a few bits of gothicness.
So. Yeah, so again, I decided to add this little activity in because we love Gothic literature so, so much that I thought, you know, we're just going to bring it into the podcast as well.
Perfect. I think that's great. We know it. I feel like we've done enough, read enough Gothic literature. We know it pretty well. So.
Indeed. So what Gothic things struck out to you within these two chapters?
Well, the supernatural aspect of it, of course, the cat metamorphosis. She's a tabby, so it wasn't the traditional black cat, which was kind of, I appreciated that. The biggest Gothic thing to me thus far was the fact that Harry was an orphan and had issues with the family he was with. What about you?
Yes, basically, my first note is, you know, evil aunt and uncle. Basically, he's a modern Jane Eyre.
Yes. That is the book that was like in my brain that I couldn't place. So 100%.
Yeah, and it's, again, and it's not just, you know, the orphan is a very common protagonist for those reasons, to be like, he feels like an outsider in the world that he lives in, and then slowly learns to discover himself as he goes on his hero's journey. So being an orphan makes that literary device very easy to use. But yeah, evil aunt and uncle, like even with Uncle Silas by Sheridan Le Fanu, Maud going to live with her Uncle Silas after her father dies, you know, Gothic literature is fraught with these really crappy aunt and uncles and relations.
Yes, for sure. And I think
in a way, Aunt Petunia is embodying that sort of probably old school sentiment of like, I'm not willing to let my relation die. Like, my conscience won't allow my relation to be abandoned. That doesn't mean I'm going to be nice about it.
Right. Yeah, sometimes I probably bring that attitude to some of my work relationships. Like, I guess I'll deal with this, but I don't have to be nice about it. So,
Definitely. And then the only thing I would say is I don't think of like immediately of the supernatural in Harry Potter as gothic, because even though that is a category in our gothometer and sublimely gothic, because there's so much magic, I'm thinking, okay, magic is the baseline and then anything above that.
Yeah. That's a good point too. Yeah.
But I will say just the idea that it's very telling that the first sort of described various instances of Harry accidentally using his magic, you know, in like some exposition, but the one that we witness in the book is with a snake. And so why specifically a snake as rather than any other specific animal? And specifically in the book we just read, Mexican Gothic, there is the symbolism of the snake in the family crest of the Doyles.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Because the snake was basically eating itself out. Like shedding its skin, but also eating, devouring itself. And that was like sort of symbolic of like the kind of plot twist that we didn't really like all that much. But yeah.
I almost wrote, as far as my list of gothic elements, I wrote snake down, I thought about it. I didn't write it down. Again, nobody's looking at this notebook, so I don't know why I have to tell you. Citing the supernatural, like you're right, and I like that observation. So much of these books are magic and supernatural based that it's not just like a is it or isn't element. And, you know, it's not like one part. I'm thinking like Dracula. He was supernatural. The rest of the world was just normal Victorian England. So we get the little bit of that, I guess, if you want to talk about setting. There's no castle yet to burn down. There's the kind of magical in the real world at Privet Drive, I guess. I don't know. I feel like I'm grasping at straws to get that. But yeah.
One thing, again, because I'm a pagan, one thing I will say, not necessarily gothic, but about, you know, the use of the snake in chapter 2 is I like the idea of the snake being shown to Harry is a very benign being. Whereas where in our world, you know, the snake is heavily stigmatized by the legend of Eve and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And the snake basically is the devil that tempted Eve. So I think in a way it's mirroring that original pagan interpretation of the snake being a neutral symbol, if not a positive symbol of fertility and stuff. And that's just Harry by himself talking to a snake totally outside the wizarding society. But then when he gets into the wizarding society, he realizes just how much there's a stigma even in that society about the snake.
Yeah, that's interesting from like a pagan perspective. I also thought about, you know, kind of a little bit of foreshadowing with the snake. I know there's a snake coming up at some point, the spiders too. And then I thought about like, why don't I have a problem with the snake, but I got a big problem with spiders. But I guess that's just, you know,
the world. Give me a choice between spiders and snakes. I choose the snake anytime.
Okay, good. I'm glad we're on the same team here because I'm doing the same.
I think we've geeked out enough on gothic stuff. How about we go to quotes?
Quotes. I don't know if I'm going to have much because I highlighted a bunch that we already both read, but
What was basically the one that, or the few that you picked?
Let me go back because I had one that I really liked. Sorry, I'm flipping through dead air. I mean, for some reason, I just loved Mr. Dursley, however, had a perfectly normal owl-free morning. I just thought that was a funny way to word things. I know that's probably not a famous quote. Flocks of owls shooting stars. Well, they're not completely stupid. The comment from Professor McGonagall about the muggles. And then I've already talked about my adoration for Dumbledore, a lemon drop. They're a kind of muggle sweet I'm rather fond of. That was kind of cute.
Yeah. And then McGonagall's like, no, who didn't think it was the time for lemon drops?
Right. Give the guy a break. Let him eat a lemon drop. Goodness, lady. And I think I had one more. Oh, and I liked the I would trust Hagrid with my life, especially kind of knowing Hagrid's character. That's a big statement, I think, that is later on the trust between those two is kind of demonstrated. I feel like I've rambled enough of my quotes. So what about you?
Yes, well, I think I like the idea of Mr. Dursley had a perfectly normal owl-free morning because, again, showing his commitment to this quote-unquote normality. And it's just like even if there are a lot of owls, like how does a lot of owls flying around like break your little bubble of suburbia? Right. Like showing how hypersensitive he is to anything out of the ordinary. And I think that hypersensitivity is coming from the fact that he knows that there's something out there that he doesn't fully understand. And so he's assigning all sort of meaning. In this way, he was right because the owls is the means by which wizards communicate. But again, assigning meaning to maybe anything out of the ordinary because he chooses to keep himself in ignorance.
Right, right. Yeah, he's definitely the desire to pretend that stuff doesn't exist, and then it kind of is up in his face.
Yeah, and then my quote that I like, which is, here, where is it? "You flatter me," said Dumbledore calmly. "Voldemort has powers I will never have, only because you're too, well, noble to use them, and noble is italicized. From that, we get the impression that Dumbledore is so, so powerful that if he were to succumb to the dark arts, he could easily wipe the floor with Voldemort.
But he won't use his powers in the way that Voldemort feels comfortable doing.
Yeah, and so I think just thinking about, you know, that sense of limiting yourself for moral reasons, again, because we're Hufflepuffs.
Right, right. Yes, exactly.
And I think that's the biggest difference between, you know, we're called Rambling Ravenpuffs, but that's kind of the biggest difference between Hufflepuffs and Ravenclaws, because Hufflepuffs very much are defined by their, like, moral compass and their moral goodness, whereas Ravenclaw is purely the pursuit of knowledge. And as far as I can see, Ravenclaw doesn't necessarily have a moral compass like Hufflepuff has. That's an integral part of its, like, personality characteristics.
Yeah, I think that, well, and I think that we have various podcasts about different literature, so that I think that is definitely very Ravenclaw-y of us. And yeah, I think my kind of kinship with Hagrid could be a little, my heart's in the right place. I feel like that is a very Hufflepuffy trait. That's my assumption thus far. And we don't even know the houses yet. We haven't been introduced to them as far as like in the chapters of the book, but knowing what we know in the tests that have been taken, I know I'm a Hufflepuff.
Yeah. And again, just that quote made me think of, you know, just that overall human quality of, you know, stopping ourselves from pursuing something because we feel there's an ethical question about it, which I feel like maybe not everyone in the White House right now is doing.
I would agree with that 100%.
But anyway, so that was my big takeaway from the, you know, quotes.
In my kind of hodgepodge there, I think it was just an appreciation for kind of Dumbledore is such a towering figure in Harry Potter. At least, you know, again, this is from my perspective of being familiar with the work, but not as in deep, you know, enmeshed in it, that he, to kind of give him some of those quirky little almost human traits, I thought was pretty, gave me a warm, fuzzy feeling for Dumbledore.
Yeah, well, and I like that because it shows him that he is like the sort of Merlin Gandalf figure, but he also has, you know, a silly side to him that maybe not everyone, like, things to portray in a fantasy novel where it's like, oh, I have to have my old, like, mentor wizard guy, and he's just old and wise, not taking the step further to be like, he's also going to be really crazy.
I think you totally nailed it right there. It gives that character some humanity, where usually it's like this towering figure who's super intelligent and that is the defining characteristic. There's nothing more. They may as well just be like a brain floating in, you know, something with spouting out different philosophies and wisdoms rather than somebody a little bit more personable person.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty then, and now we move on to fan fiction time.
Well, I feel like mine are going to be very common. So.
Okay, but so basically you pose a scenario to me, and then I will say what would happen differently because of that.
Okay. Oh, I don't know which one to do. I'm going to go with the second one I wrote. What if the Dursleys were very supportive of Harry?
Oh, I didn't even think of that one. If the Dursleys were very supportive of Harry.
Like they helped him and like they were like, you're going to go to this place eventually. It's super cool. And you're, you know, they just tried to cultivate this wizard rather than totally shun.
I don't know. Again, it's really hard for me to envision the Dursleys as supportive, but I think the way I see it panning out would be that the Dursleys maybe would still keep the secret, at least until he was maybe like 9 or 10, uh-huh. But they wouldn't necessarily if he had these like sort of magical accidents, they would know what's going on, but they wouldn't punish him for it. But I think maybe like around this time, they would like sit him down and be like, okay, this is the deal. You're going to go to this school soon. And again, how that would impact the rest of the series, the fact that he, you know, could have had relatives that he could have wrote letters to, and Hedwig could have sent, you know, given him letters, and they could send him little care packages of Muggle candies.
Right. Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad I picked a good one, because I was really, really trying to do a good, like, I'm glad your response wasn't what it was.
And then my is the opposite. What if Aunt Petunia had refused to take in Harry?
So then maybe it would have been the opposite. Do we think that Dumbledore would have just been envisioning him as like a caring person, and then Hagrid and Professor McGonagall's, you know, kind of care for him? I feel like they would have taken him to Hogwarts.
Mm.
And then he would have just kind of been part of that. And then, you know, several of these questions that I thought of while reading it, it's like, well, then the rest of these books wouldn't exist. But I guess with the question you pose, it would have just been a very different perspective. And he already, I know, is kind of seen as a golden boy, which is very different from mm-hmm. his life right now. So I feel like that would have just been worse. I think you could have still made the stories, but just minus the Dursleys. It just would have been a little, I don't know, more magic. But the conflict of the Muggle world makes it a little more interesting.
Alrighty then, and that concludes the very first episode of the Rambling Raven Puffs. Thank you so much. Again, if you want to possibly hear your questions on the air, don't forget to leave a comment or a post on our Facebook group, the Raven Puff Common Room. Make sure to check it out. And next week, we will be going over chapters 3 and 4. Take care, guys. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.